they may have to go further to get food.
Well, that's true.
Yeah.
I can give up. Okay, ready?
Yep.
All right, let's go ahead and call the meeting to order. I know we have a couple more members who are probably returning, but I believe we have a quorum. And we do have a lot of business in this session, and we do want to finish on time so that people could get to their airplanes. So we're going to start with Nancy Green giving a report on implementing point-of-care newborn screening, tab 7 in your agenda book. This may require a vote for product support. Is that correct? Okay.
Well, thank you, Dr. Bussini, for allowing me to give this report. And I think I don't have to say that the obvious, which is it's, I think this is a timely report given the focus of the various foci of this meeting. So thank you very much. I look forward to the discussion following my presentation and expect that Colleen and Jeff, as current or former co-chairs and involved with this process, as well as Alex Kemper and others around the table who have been active writers, co-writers, that you'll be involved in the discussion as well. So it was just about a year ago, actually the January meeting of 2011, that we first started talking about pulling together the thoughts on point of care newborn screening. And I would like to point out that the gestational period for a horse is 11 months and for a camel is 12. So just FYI. Okay, so I'm going to summarize the manuscript that's in your briefing materials. I think what you have is probably accurately described as a penultimate draft. Identify any remaining issues for the manuscript. And in fact, some things that have arisen from today's discussion I'd like to add. And then to solicit input support as appropriate from this committee. For the sake of time, I'm going to go through the slides very fast, but please interrupt me if you'd like a clarification, or we can get back to it. So the point of care testing itself has previously been defined as testing, or in this case would be screening, at the point of a site of patient care, with the driving notion being that the test and, of course, the results would be a convenience and immediacy to the results. And that would improve the likelihood of receiving results and making timely medical decisions. And obviously that the centralized laboratory would not constitute point of care screening. So the context of the manuscript, I think, is, as I said, is obvious. And the juxtaposition between public health and pediatric care about newborns also involved issues regarding how decisions are made, the evidence review that we do, and then some of the others that came up earlier, particularly the task force, and then the triple R's, you know, the roles, responsibility, and resources. And I think actually, Colleen, when you discussed the report this morning of the subcommittee on treatment, follow-up and treatment, that the CCHD presentation from Maryland was exemplified many of the issues around those triple R's. And in fact, the manuscript, as I hope you've seen, is far from prescriptive. It really is to outline the issues, and that with the understanding that many of the distribution of those roles, responsibilities, and resources will likely vary by condition. And so I'd just like to list the co-authors. If anybody here feels that they are not on the list and feel that they ought to be, we're happy to. We've already sort of exceeded the 6 author limit, so we're happy to include you. Right, but I would like to acknowledge the contributions of many wise people. Again, this is a framework for evaluation. Defining what point of care screening really is, and whether then helping provide some background as far as making decisions about whether point of care screening tests could be added to the panel, And I'd say the slant of the manuscript is really, we tried to take the public health perspective, but also incorporate issues around providers, nursery procedures, and the like, and the public. So the manuscript is organized, as you can see, the definitions, and the potential of decentralized screening in terms of immediacy results. And that may be beyond the context of this meeting, this discussion, but I would like to sort of raise the question that point-of-care screening for some disorders where immediate results and action are needed may lead to some consideration eventually, depending upon a myriad of issues, including capacity, around the current panel, you know, galactosemia or something like that. But again, that's not for today's discussion. What are the characteristics of newborn screening? I don't have to talk to this group about, and the point being that it's an essential public health activity. And I think, you know, again, this concept was described very well in the discussions of hyperbilirubinemia screening, to ensure uniform quality and evidence-based recommendations. So what would be then what we're proposing as the inclusion criteria for point of care screening would be all of the usual important aspects for newborn screening, and then additional criteria, and that would be the urgency of recognition and treatment beyond what would be feasible for a centralized laboratory, and that the screening would be physiologic based, and you know, of course, TCB or pulse oximetry exemplify that. Again, as the discussion I think this morning really brought to light, that the issue is, in deciding whether something should be, a condition should be part of clinical care or within the recommended uniform panel, if there are better outcomes, if it's performed under public health mandate. And I think that that's a guiding principle. And then the other aspects being standardization of the technology, feasibility of the decentralized implementation, which I think makes everybody nervous because we haven't done that yet, and it's just happening now with CCHD, that screening is feasible in the nursery given how orderly nurseries are, assure, of course, that follow-up diagnosis and care can be provided in a timely and appropriate fashion. So as I mentioned earlier, there's not a single prescription for point-of-care screening. Depends on the condition and then also other factors, including potentially state legislation. And then other aspects that are relevant to public health and are familiar to public health, and that those would be risks of missed cases, the complexity of the screening paradigms. You know, one can imagine if the screening would require, an MRI under anesthesia. I mean, that's obviously a ridiculous extreme, but, you know, that would not be something feasible for point-of-care screening. The extent to which the screening is already part of standard care, and I think that topic has been covered, exemplified this morning. The challenges of confirmatory diagnosis, and we haven't really talked about that today, but certainly that's come up with the CCHD. And the potential for variability in screening procedures, the validity of the procedures, actually both screening and diagnosis, and those are obviously quite serious considerations. Okay, so to try to sort of divide we used to say buckets, but actually you're saying lanes today, so I'm going to borrow from you, Colleen, to identify the lanes. Divided this by public health providers and other entities. So for public health, the assurance about quality and feasibility in a statewide manner with the overriding issues of quality, timeliness, and equitable delivery of services, assuring feasibility of statewide surveillance, and actually that's come up with respect to CCHD, the integration of clinical services and tracking into the existing systems for newborn screening, and then to assess the impact on clinical care and certainly informing the public. And that's not something that we spent a lot of time with this morning, but I think that's an obvious point that would be non-controversial. Okay, so for the issues for providers and for nurseries, understanding that they're not the same, and you know, we've in the past talked about how hospital agencies that represent hospitals have not been part of this discussion, and so I just would like to remind us of that. For providers in the nursery and pediatric providers immediately thereafter involved with the diagnosis and treatment, that there's obviously infrastructure required. As I mentioned, the practicality of doing anything in an already loaded nursery schedule. Costs involved, as we've discussed, the responsibilities of the providers within the nurseries, and then the providers who would be involved with diagnosis and service delivery. And I think that's something that actually needs to be identified as an important factor. And then assessing the impact on routine care. The other issues, certainly around coordination, are not trivial, as I'm sure most of you would recognize, that there are many stakeholders around nursery procedures, including, of course, families. As I mentioned, the primary care, the newborn nursery services, hospitals, public health agencies, and payers, and that there really needs to be coordination and collaboration and leadership, I guess, amongst the variety of entities. And the issues that I mentioned about the coordination and avoiding disparities of poor quality services. So as we understand, you know, birth hospitals would have considerable responsibility, obviously, for providing high quality, presumably standardized screening equipment. They'd have to employ their current or additional employees to do the screening, to provide standardized techniques for performing the screening, recording the results, and communicating those results, both to the family and through the public health, to ensure continuous quality, and as I mentioned, the timely reporting, and then the coordination across the diagnosis and therapy. There are some additional issues just to raise, including the criteria. I think I don't need to talk about this since I think covered this very well this morning around hyperbilirubinemia, around criteria for clinical services versus the recommended uniform panel, the interface between all of the various stakeholders, the insurance of input from professional organizations and families, data capture, gaps in funding, and then a point that actually I'd like to attribute to Jeff, if you don't mind, and that is the acceptability to parents, because, you know, as these conditions, if they're added, you know, we don't know, there's no sort of limit to the number, but they're all being done in front of parents, and so there may be acceptability issues that are new, and there have been studies done looking at acceptability of hearing screening, for example, where the vast majority of parents found that to be acceptable, you know, over 90%, and these were studies, I think one performed a large study in 2001, but we don't know what subsequent screening would do, and again, when we start talking about multiple different procedures, there may be issues. And again, according to this 2001 report, only seven states required parental consent for hearing screening. So again, you know, what would that do to the understanding for most states that consent is not required for newborn screening? So I think those are actually real issues. So thank you, Jeff, for bringing that up. So in summary, this is a manuscript that has been from created, written by the follow-up and treatment subcommittee. And to paraphrase Winston Churchill, this is the end of the beginning for point of care screening. And that some of these issues, I mean, as we sort of think about and deliberate about both specific conditions and also the sort of generic concept of point of care screening, that there may be some implications for screening beyond the newborn nursery that we should just kind of keep in mind. So we seek the support of the manuscript by the committee. We've had some discussion about whether this should be a subcommittee report, or in fact, if there are any subcommittee reports, whether it should be instead a report from the committee. And then we, of course, would like to submit this to peer review publication and identify next steps, which would certainly, of course, be the existing issues, unfolding issues around CCHD as it expands. And then also to really think about whether we do need to engage additional stakeholders, the hospital associations being just one, probably the nurses in the nursery, and potentially others. So I just raise those as questions. And we thank you.
All right, thank you. All right, this is open for discussion. The paper was in the agenda book and available, and so from my view, I think it's a very well-written and comprehensive document. I think it as you indicated, very nicely describes the issues and where we are. So, Colleen?
I was just going to add one thing to Nancy. Maybe if you can leave that last slide up, even though we like the pictures of the babies.
That
one right there, yeah. So really what we were considering was that this would be an informational document that we would provide to this secretary as really, for education information. So that was if we go back to Sarah's list, this would be number two, I guess, yeah.
All right. Any questions or comments? Any issues related to moving forward?
I have no issues related to moving forward.
Okay.
Can I just ask clarification? Support of the manuscript by the ACHDNC.
Mm-hmm.
Support in what? That we are formally endorsing it? That we are.
Can't endorse it.
Exactly. So what does support mean exactly? Just.
That we think it's a good idea, that it contains, that we're in agreement with what is said in the manuscript.
We're in agreement with what's said.
The points, the summaries that were made.
The summary points. That's mm-hmm. different from. Those of us who are feds are undoubtedly thinking, do we need to have clearance, for instance, to do this? Obviously, if we were to sign on to a document, we would need clearance. Mm-hmm. And I'm just trying to tease out whether this raises the level of actually needing clearance rather than just, gee, it's a great idea.
Beverly can't say the very specific issue is it's not an endorsement because that has legal implications, and that's why it was not labeled as endorsement.
And actually, it would say on the that our usual disclaimer line on it.
Yeah.
I don't
this
know if you actually look at the yeah.
So it, just to be clear, then I guess what we're talking about is. The byline, right, would list all the authors, and then it would specifically identify the committee,
mm-hmm.
right?
With the having supported this.
Well,
if it's
listing the committee members is somehow endorsing it, then I would need to get clearance.
No.
I mean, signing on to the document, just like any article. If I was writing an article that said, the sky was blue or anything else.
So this reflects the will of the committee. And if the committee votes and says that they support this, it'll go forward. If you need to abstain, you can. But it won't specifically identify you, and there will be some kind of disclaimer in there that this is not this is not individual works, this is not the individual representation, but this is, reflects the work.
And just be, so it does. And so the members of the committee, by supporting this, are not being listed as some kind of semi-authors or whatever.
Correct.
It's just exactly, that's
right.
Fine.
Correct. Which has been the process for other articles that have come from subcommittees here. So,
just to clarify, I mean, I think it's a document that's out there that kind of frames how you can look at this. We're not putting out any specific recommendations
Correct.
In the document.
Correct.
So that's
Right.
kind of the way I would view it.
Right. Correct. All right. If there are no other questions or comments, I'll entertain a motion to approve this report. Jeff?
I move to support this report under, is it category
two. Second.
Stephen seconds that motion. So now we need to know if there be anybody who will need to abstain. Hearing none,
sure.
We're going to the next one. We're going to
I could.
Go.
So,
your choice.
Yes. Kathy Wickland. Okay. Fred Laurie.
Yes.
Charlie Homer. Don Bailey. Joe Bocchini.
Approve.
Alexis Thompson.
Approve.
Andrea Williams.
Approve.
Agency for Healthcare Quality and Research.
Approve.
Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, Dieter.
Oh, I'm not done yet.
Oh,
I've
yeah.
got a whole bunch more.
Right.
Yeah.
There's a plan.
Yeah, not really, but Jeff Botkin.
Approve.
Dieter Matern.
I approve too.
Steve McDonough.
Aye.
Okay. Food and Drug Administration, Kelly Kell.
Approve.
Health Resources and Services Administration, Michael Liu.
Approve.
National Institutes of Health, Ellen
Goodwalker. Approve.
And Charlie Homer, are you on the phone? Okay. So the motion passes.
All right. Thank you all very much. Thank you, Nancy.
Oh, thank you very much.
Joe.
Yes.
Can I raise a topic for conversation about this? And I think the paper does a nice job of sort of articulating what the general framework is, what the potential responsibilities are of different stakeholders, et cetera. I don't think it yet, and I don't think it's ripe for this determination, but just to raise it for perhaps some discussion here, how do we decide of those point of care examinations that are common for babies, which ones might fall within the purview of this committee? And which ones might not. And we had a little bit of that conversation with hyperbilirubinemia. And so, you know, if the Academy of Pediatrics says we think every baby ought to be screened for hyperbilirubinemia, what's the difference between that sort of recommendation and one that might come to this committee? And are there aspects of the condition or aspects of the funding or politics or whatever that would bring it before this body as opposed to the other professional bodies that make recommendations all the time about what they think the standard of care is? And again, I don't think this paper is ready to draw that line, but I think at some point the committee needs to think about that issue.
It is an important issue, and I think you're right. As time goes on, there will be other things, and we'll need to address that more formally. I agree.
Maybe the paper needs to be a little more explicit about that, raising that question.
Well, there's also the fact that any consumer can bring, or any group can bring forward a condition, whether or not they think it should be added to the newborn screening panel. And hopefully the public health impact analysis will be robust enough in the condition review that if it goes to the condition review, that will be adequately addressed. And hopefully those will be some options. The other reason for cooperating more closely with Community Guide and the U.S. Task Force is that if we can get a process that is closer to theirs in terms of condition voting, et cetera, there may be a possibility for having some reciprocity between the two groups. And so if we do get something that might be more appropriate for the task force, it may be something that we can develop a mechanism to address.
All right. Chris.
Nancy brought up the idea about something else in early childhood kind of screening. And I think there's some, one of the things about this universality is the idea that you're in the hospital and it's right after you're born. When you do screening in clinical care, you have to be in that healthcare system. Some people are not in the healthcare system. And so in terms of finding and doing universal screening really brings another issue. So I think that's why CCHD, which is saying kids are in newborn hearing screening, they're in the hospital, that's the way you capture them. After that, I think there's a lot of other complications in doing. An example in states with lead screening mandates. We've got lead screening mandates, but we're never getting it to 100%, and the way we follow it is to provide feedback to docs about what's happening and that, but it's not a captive population in
right.
some sense.
Right. Good point. Okay, let's move forward with the with the next presentations on congenital congenital heart disease implementation. I'm going to reverse the order. Colleen has a plane to catch, so we're going to let her go first and talk about the federal plan of action for critical congenital heart disease.
Great. So that was appended to my morning's presentation. It's Boyle. So I'll get started without the slides. As you know, or maybe remember, in September, when the Secretary of decided to go forward with the screening for accept the original proposal that was brought forward by the committee and accepted the CCHD as part of the recommended uniform screening panel. She came back with specific charges for the agencies, and I'm presenting the work of the various agencies. Presenting for my colleagues the work of the various agencies in responding to that directive by the Secretary. And if you also remember, when the recommendation went forward to the Secretary, we actually highlighted for each agency as part of that recommendation what the agency's the responsibility for the agencies. So it's there. Yeah, great. Oops. Okay, just stay there. I got it. Good. All right. This is my trying to be efficient last night. As you remember, NIH was essentially charged with research, both for research in terms of the actually advancing the technology to identify children with CCHD, as well as research related to looking at outcomes related to care and treatment. There's three bullets here. In terms of activities involving two NIH agencies, NHLBI and NICHD, NIHLBI is providing guidance relative to, they have a common nomenclature tool for coding and classifying congenital cardiovascular malformations. Some of you may be familiar with this, so this is being made widely available. It's part of their Pediatric Cardiovascular Research Network. And if you skip to the third bullet there, they also have a Pediatric Heart Network. This is 9 clinical sites, and they're assessing the current practices related to CCHD and whether or not the Pediatric Heart Network could provide the venue for conducting evaluations of screening. So they already have this network. And then some of you in the states may know which states, so it would behoove you, I guess, to know which states these networks are in. You could link on this Pediatric Heart Network, and that might help facilitate, from your perspective, some ongoing evaluation as you roll out your state programs. The Health Resources and Services Administration was charged with appropriately helping with the implementation with state health departments for screening, as well as the education. And many of you, or I think most of you in the room, are aware of the fact that there's an FOA out on the street from HRSA to fund 6 demonstration projects for the implementation of CCHD in the states. Those projects will be funded for 3 years. HRSA is also assisting the Newborn Screening Clearinghouse to work with NHLBI and other stakeholders to have the most accurate education materials on the website. There's materials that are already available, and actually in prior meetings we had several of those presenters who have those materials come and discuss those with us. And they're also working with the National Newborn Screening Genetics Resource Center to provide state technical assistance as requested. CDC was charged with the ongoing evaluation and surveillance tracking, looking at cost effectiveness and leveraging electronic health records. So in the first bundle, we have surveyed, and we've done this twice now, all of our state programs to see where they are in terms of their capacity. This one was prior to the actual acceptance by the secretary, and then most recently we surveyed the states to get a better sense of what's going on there. This week we just started we call our epidemiologic aid or epi aid project in New Jersey. This is a fairly intense view of really what's going on, focusing on real mechanics, analyzing the data flow and tracking in hospitals and following up on missed screens. So we'll have an evaluation that's a 30-day window for those epi aid projects. And so we'll have results that could be shared and will be shared and made available to others. And then we have a webinar in March and April really to provide technical assistance to state birth defects and newborn screening programs. Concurrent with what we're doing in New Jersey, we're starting something new, which is essentially the equivalent of an epi aid, but it's economic aid. So we're trying to assess what the cost to the hospital is, real-time cost to the hospital for implementation of newborn screening. And then we're also developing a cost-effectiveness model using the experience of 3 other states within that context. Doing some work on trying to leverage electronic health records. This really predated what we were doing with the secretary's decision. So we had an electronic health record activity, which is interfacing with HHS level activities, but now we're trying to concentrate it much more on congenital heart disease. So that's my federal update.
Thank you. Questions or comments? All right, thank you, Colleen.
Thanks.
Appreciate it. Safe trip back. Now we have Lorraine Garg. Dr. Garg is the Medical Director of Special Health and Early Intervention Services, Medical Director of Newborn Screening and Genetic Services for the New Jersey Department of Health and Senior Services.
Thank you very much. I know that we're short on time, so I'm just going to whip through this pretty quickly. I was asked to speak about New Jersey's experience with implementing pulse oximetry screening. Sorry. Okay. I think probably the best place to start is right at the beginning, and for us, the beginning was June 2nd, 2011. That's the date that Governor Christie signed into effect legislation that put New Jersey as the first state to mandate pulse oximetry screening in newborns to detect critical congenital heart disease. Up on the screen, I have an excerpt of the key portion of our legislation, which reads, "The Commissioner of Health and Senior Services shall require each birthing facility licensed by the Department of Health to perform a pulse oximetry screening a minimum of 24 hours after birth on every newborn in its care." From the date of signing of the legislation, we had 90 days until we needed to enact the legislation, so that put us at August 31st. And I just wanted to also mention that the legislation was unfunded. The first thing that we needed to do really was to decide what the role of the department would be in all this. And so while the hospitals were mandated to screen every baby, the decision was made that we weren't going to mandate how they should screen. This was a point of care test, and pertinent to the discussion that we just had earlier. The thought was that since the babies are in the hospital under the care of medical providers, that the hospitals really needed to be responsible for ensuring follow-up and not the Department of Health. Along the same lines, the decision was made that we would not conduct active follow-up of the abnormal screens in the same way that we do with abnormal biochemical newborn screens. The Division of Licensing was charged with overseeing the hospital compliance with the legislation, and they're within the Department of Health, but a different division from where newborn screening sits, which is over in Family Health Services. Initially, newborn screening was charged with developing a best practice guidelines document, but as we got into this rather quickly, we realized that if we wanted to build an effective screening and surveillance system, that we really needed to expand the scope of our involvement, really in order to support and guide implementation efforts at the hospital level. So the first thing that we did was we convened a working group, the Critical Congenital Heart Disease Screening Working Group. It's been a wonderful group of dedicated individuals. We've got cardiologists, neonatologists, pediatricians, nurses, nurse midwives, parent advocates. We've got representation from the New Jersey American Academy of Pediatrics, as well as our New Jersey Hospital Association and our Maternal and Child Health Consortia. And in addition, we've got representation from the Department of Health. So we had myself from newborn screening, somebody from birth defects registry, somebody from the hearing screen, and also from licensing. Initially, our main focus was really to develop a recommended protocol, the concern being that we weren't mandating how the hospitals were screening, so we really wanted to get something out to them before the effective date of the legislation so that they could look to that, because the concern was that there was the potential that every hospital would do their own thing and potentially not use the evidence in developing those protocols. This is a copy of our protocol, and I just passed out some copies of it. We were very fortunate to have been able to get a pre-release of the algorithm that was to be published in Pediatrics from the strategies paper, the algorithm that was developed by the expert panel from this advisory committee. And so we used that as the foundation for development of our algorithm. Mainly the two differences between the two are that our legislation mandated screening of all babies in the hospital. So basically this reflects that and includes NICU babies in the protocol. The other difference was to pass, you needed to have 95 or greater in both extremities, upper and lower. And the reason for that, and not just in one extremity, and the reason for that really was to just try and increase the sensitivity, though we did realize that it might also increase the false positive rate. We also spent a lot of time trying to simplify the algorithm. We weren't going to have time to do intensive training, and so we wanted to try and make it as simple and break up the steps as best we could. As far as education and training, we did do two webinars. The first one was at the time we released the protocol, and that one was really just to provide an overview of CCHD, of pulse oximetry screening, to go over the protocol and to talk with the hospitals about implementation, and that was archived on a website. The second webinar that we did was a couple months later, and that one was more around data collection and reporting. Informally, we've had a lot of frequent communication with the hospitals, a lot of back and forth, and a lot of technical assistance that we've been providing, but really had not had time to do the intensive training efforts that we would have liked. And we've got a whole slew of things planned. A lot of it's really dependent on resources. Right now, we are working on developing the best practice guidelines document. Members of the working group have agreed to write some of those sections. We're working on developing a parent education brochure. And some of the important things that I would like to do, and we're slowly trying to make headway with it, is to really get into the hospital. So to develop a train-the-trainer model, to get to the nurses who are doing the screening, and also to develop a standardized slide deck to have cardiologists and neonatologists go around to the different hospitals through Grand Rounds. As far as surveillance, we actually didn't get our data system up and running until probably about 2 months after implementation. Spent a lot of time at the beginning trying to find a way to collect individual level data on the babies. I explored the blood spot cards, the immunization registry, our electronic birth certificate that we have. Unfortunately, that would have been ideal, but it's an antiquated system, and so there was no way of adding any other fields to the EBC. Fortunately for us, New Jersey is just in the beginning stages of developing a new electronic birth certificate. So hopefully within a year and a half or so, we should have that up and running and be able to collect individual level data. What we did do and what we are doing in the interim is collecting quarterly aggregate data from each of the hospitals. We're requesting the number of births and the number of babies screened, and then also there to explain any discrepancy between the two numbers. And then also we're using our birth defects registry to capture information on all failed screens. The hospitals report failed screens, whether it's a true positive or not. And then right now what's happening is one of the nurses from the birth defects registry is calling the hospitals and following up on those and asking a series of questions that we developed to get the screen results, the results of the evaluation that's done, prenatal history, and any pre-existing history of symptoms prior to the screen. Fortunate for us, this nurse has been at the department for over 25 years and has really wonderful relationships with all the nurses in the different hospitals, and that's really facilitated the communication. This has been a great learning process for us. Eventually, we will go to an electronic module, but this has been a great way for us both to get information to the hospitals and also to get information back to help us refine our data questions. It was mentioned that right now in New Jersey, as we speak actually, we've got an Epi Aid going on and the Econ Aid, and we do hope to get information from that. They're visiting 11 hospitals and doing interviews, and so we hope to get information back from that that'll help us further refine these questions. Ultimately, when the EBS or the new EBC is up and running, we'll probably in a year and a half or so be able to collect individual level data through that. And then also likely we'll continue collecting the failed screens through the information on the failed screens through the birth defects registry. So I just want to switch gears a little and just share with you a little bit of the data that we have so far. The first thing, this is from a survey that I did of the hospitals in early August before we had implemented, and just trying to assess the lay of the land. What I wanted to share with you is that of the 52 hospitals at the time, 9 of them, or 17%, did not have access to echocardiograms, and the significance of that is that if those hospitals happen to have a failed screen, potentially they would need to transport the baby. About 2 months into it, I sent out another survey. This was actually right before a meeting, so I didn't do any follow-up, so I was actually happy with the 50% response rate. Interestingly, all the hospitals that responded said that they were actually using our recommended protocol. And overall, I asked them about how implementation was going, and for the most part, most said it was going fairly smoothly. I think the biggest challenge that our hospitals faced was trying to develop a mechanism to track the babies that they were screening. Some easily were able to incorporate it into their EMRs, their electronic health records. Others, it's been a challenge for them, and some are still using paper and pencil logs, which is very laborious for them. I just want to mention back on that slide, in addition, we really didn't get, or at least I didn't hear that much pushback from the hospitals, and most of the nurses and most of the hospitals said it was fairly easy to incorporate and just treat it as another vital sign. I've titled this preliminary data. It's very much preliminary, and if I could have put a big watermark that said draft across it, I would have. We just got our first quarterly reports within the last couple weeks. We got it on all. We have it on all of the hospitals, except we're missing one hospital at this point. So this is really changing as we have back and forth with the hospitals as we get data. The data's been changing, but I just wanted to give you a sense of where we're at. So basically, the first number is the number of live births that we would have that would be responsible have. We would have expected to have been screened 24,807. Of those babies, 24,343 were screened, so that was 98%. We had 9 failed screens, and 2 of those were in asymptomatic babies that did have critical congenital heart disease. So just wanted to discuss just a little bit our challenges and then our strengths, and then I'll close. So overall, I think the major challenge was the 90-day implementation period. We were able to get up and running within that time, but you know, we find that now we're doing a lot of the things that ideally we would have done prior to implementing at the statewide level. This was an unfunded mandate. We were short-staffed before we started, and this has put a stress on, you know, the staffing that we had, and it's affected the speed with which we can move forward. And I just put on here the inclusion of all infants, including the NICU babies. It's not a straightforward screening in NICU babies, as is mentioned in the, you know, the strategies paper, and I'm happy to go into that further with anybody who is interested afterwards. As far as education, I mentioned that we really do need to get out and do more intensive training, and skipping to the surveillance system. The accuracy of the data, it's been a real steep learning curve for us, but I think that's to be expected with any surveillance system that's implemented, and we're just at the beginning of it. As far as the aggregate data, you know, I think it's sufficient. I think it gives us a picture of what's going on. But it's complicated. We've got babies, especially since we're screening the NICU babies, we've got babies that are born in one quarter, but appropriately so, aren't screened for a couple months later until the next quarter. We've got transfers in, transfers out. So dealing with that in aggregate data is just challenging. Once we go to individual level data, that will largely be eliminated. And then quality assurance, obviously incredibly important in data collection and something that will remain a challenge for us as long as our resources are what they are. As far as the strengths, I think, you know, the good thing is we got up and running, and we got up and running fast. And in the first 90 days, we had greater than 95% of the infants in the birthing facilities that were screened. In talking with the hospitals, they're aware of the gaps and the missed babies, and I think that that number is only going to get higher. We put in place a mechanism to collect data for program evaluation. It's a work in progress, but we're able to get a sense of what's going on out there. And I think we covered a lot of ground with very limited resources. And it really couldn't have happened, I think, without our committed working group, the dedicated staff at the department, and I think also the established connections that we already have with the birthing facilities. I close with a picture. This is baby Dylan Gordon. He's the first baby that was identified through the pulse ox screening program, and there's just a quote that was from a letter that his family had written to the governor. And then this is my email address. If anybody has any questions, I'm happy to shed light on what we've done. Thank you.
Thank you. That's a wonderful presentation and shows a dramatic implementation effort that has led to some very good rewards already. So I think that's wonderful. Questions or comments? Alexis?
Just for clarification, I know I'm not by any means wanting to hold you to the numbers, but when you mentioned the two true cases that they were asymptomatic, during that same time period, were there other cases that were symptomatic that but were also screened?
Yeah, so in the nine fails, and we're actually still having conversations with the hospitals, but yeah, there was one of the babies was prenatally diagnosed, asymptomatic, but prenatally diagnosed. So I didn't count that in the two. I was trying to get at the two cases that we wouldn't have otherwise caught.
Colleen, and then Jeff.
Do you have information on the seven that weren't true cases?
I do, but I think I'd
rather not share that.
I think we need to talk with the hospitals more.
No problem.
Yeah.
Any general impression you can share of them? Or
of the fails?
Oh, yeah.
Two of them, as best I can tell at this point, I think probably would have otherwise been detected, not from, you know, even if we hadn't been screening. There were a couple that, there was one that has a diagnosis of sepsis, a couple, that we need to look into a little further. Yeah. You know, I don't know at this point that I can say, oh, they had conditions that wouldn't have been, you know, that it was still important to detect. I don't know enough about them at this point.
Jeff?
Yeah, a question about funding. I'm wondering how the hospitals are billing this out, whether they've had any challenges with billing for the screening service. And then on the health department side, are you considering any funding model for the level of support that you're providing, or is it going to continue to be an unfunded activity?
As far as the hospitals, so it's anecdotal at this point, from what I know about the hospitals. I think that the sense I'm getting is most of them have just absorbed it, that they're not able to bill for it because they're either bundled in their reimbursement. So I don't know if that's something that when they negotiate it, you know, their next time that they have negotiations, that they'll be able to include that or not. We did get some concerns raised about the cost, but it wasn't a huge pushback that we got. Some initially with the reusable probes and trying to find out, you know, how to purchase that, it was something that we heard a little bit about. But we had concerns about, you know, would even transports be covered in a well-appearing baby, but we just don't have enough, I don't have enough experience to know that. As far as at the department, we applied for the HRSA grant. You know, I think other than that, I don't get the sense that if we go for a fee increase that this would be, that money would go towards this. Our revenue is from, in newborn screening, is through the kits, the newborn screening kits that we sell. And no, I think this was an unfunded mandate.
Kelly Light, I just wanted to say that as a New Jersey resident and consumer advocate, I want to commend you on putting together a remarkable program with a remarkable saturation, you know, coverage of the babies over a short period of time with no funding. I think it's pretty incredible, and I commend you for that. Thank you,
Kelly.
Other questions, comments? Again, I think the committee feels the same way, so thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate you coming. The last implementation presentation is by Mr. Bob Bowman. Mr. Bowman is the Director of Genomics and Newborn Screening Program at Indiana State Department of Health, and he oversees the screening program, early hearing detection and interventional program, and genomic programs and the registry.
That is correct. Well, things moved fairly quickly in Indiana as well, not quite as quickly as they did in New Jersey, but in the spring of 2011, we started hearing that there was a bill that was proposed to our state legislature to include congenital heart defects on our newborn screen, and that was the proposal, that it would actually be added to our newborn screening law. There were other priorities for the legislature that year, and it sort of just disappeared for a while. We didn't hear much about it. But then in June, we heard that it had been added to our state law, and we were told that we had to give a report to the legislature on October 31st, and that we had to go statewide screening as of January 1st, 2012. So this put us in a little bit of a dilemma. We had to quickly assess where we were and what was going on. It also sort of spelled out what our responsibilities were by adding it to the newborn screening law. What this meant, the way it was incorporated, the State Department of Health, specifically the newborn screening program, was going to be responsible for developing a tracking and surveillance component. But there was another part of our law which says that we're also responsible for the follow-up and the diagnostic part, which that was set aside for pulse oximetry screening. So the first thing we did was we really tried to quickly assess where we stood as a state and what we needed to do. There were five things that we sort of teased out that we needed to address. First thing, we wanted the complete recommendations from the Secretary's Advisory Committee. Alex's paper had not yet been released, so it made it a little difficult as to what we could share with the different physicians and birthing facilities across the state. We have 100 birthing facilities in Indiana. give or take. It seems to change on a daily basis. The second thing, we wanted to determine the capacity of the birthing facilities to do this screening. How many of them actually had these pulse oximeters, had the appropriate probes, how many of them could do it? The third thing was we wanted to get feedback from pediatric cardiologists in Indiana. When this was first brought to our attention, we did a little research to determine how many pediatric cardiologists there are in Indiana. And we're fortunate to have an integrated database, and we actually have the licensing information in Indiana. So we were able to find out that there were 24 pediatric cardiologists in the state, and most of them were associated with one of the two larger birthing or hospital groups. So we wanted to get in touch with them and find out, you know, what was their take? How did they think that this law, this new change would how would it affect them? We also wanted to determine how the birthing facilities felt about implementing this screening. For us, this was arguably the most important thing. And the reason that is we've seen in the past that the medical field at times can view these things as it is the state telling us what to do. And we didn't want them to feel this way. We wanted them to feel that this was a collaboration. We are in this together. We'll get through this. And so we really wanted to see how they took it. And there was some misconception that people didn't understand or didn't recognize that the Secretary's Committee had made this recommendation, or even that their own legislature had passed this law. So there was some education to do on that side. The final priority was identify what data would be collected and how it would be collected. This is our final priority because we realized this was going to be a difficult task. It was not something that we could probably fully address by January 1st, but we figured we could have a pretty good head start, hopefully, and establish the framework to move forward. So the first thing we did was we developed a list of individuals that we felt we needed to contact and start developing a rapport with, and that included the neonatologists, the nurses, the pediatric cardiologists, and the birthing facilities. We sent out a survey. As I mentioned before, we have an integrated system in Indiana, so we have access to a lot of email addresses through Medicaid and through the licensing board. So we did surveys and e-blasts and things like that. First, we just wanted to take more of a broad approach and determine where things stood. We asked questions such as, does your facility already perform pulse oximetry screening? Can you perform it? Do you have the capacity? Do you have people who are trained to do this? And we heard back from about half of the birthing facilities. And what we heard in general was that, yes, most of them did have the capacity to actually do pulse oximetry screening. So we thought that was a very good thing. That was something that we felt we could move forward with. The other significant thing was that we found about 60%, 58% that did report back to us, said that they could do the echo at their own facility as well, which meant that these children would not need to be referred to another facility. So this was significant as well. We discussed how exactly this would happen because we knew there were only 24 pediatric cardiologists in the state. And what we heard was that a lot of them have the technicians who can do the pediatric echo, and then the results would be transmitted electronically to a pediatric cardiologist who they're working with, who would actually interpret those results. So that made us feel a little better as well. And you can see down below, we started teasing out some of the specifics. Riley Hospital for Children is part of the IU Health System Network, and St. Vincent Hospital is part of the Ascension Health Network, and those are the two largest networks in our state. After talking to Indiana physicians and after actually getting the protocols from Alex's paper, we provided the physicians with that information. They reviewed the protocols, and in general, they didn't see any problem with implementing them statewide. They still had a lot of questions, specifically about NICU children, about premature children, things like that. How would these screens be done? Through this whole process, I had a number of discussions with our legal staff about what we could do and what we couldn't do. It was at this point that I was advised that we could not make additional recommendations about those children. Basically, all that we could say is that it was up to each birthing facility to develop their own protocols for NICU children and premature children. So that's basically what we had to tell the different birthing facilities. That was not an easy thing for me to do, and it was not an easy thing for them to hear. Also, we heard back a little bit from the pediatric cardiologist. We didn't communicate with them directly. We were working through the neonatologists who were meeting with the pediatric cardiologist. But the main things that we heard from them were they had some concerns about once this goes statewide, what are we going to see in the way of number of false positives? Because we do have 100 birthing facilities, there are some smaller birthing facilities. What's the number of false positives going to look like, and how inundated are they going to become? That's something that we don't have an answer for at this particular point in time because we just started January 1st. The other real question that they had was the transportation issue. 40% of the children will need to be transferred to another facility. And the recommendations are in a timely manner. So there is some question, what exactly does that mean? Do we have to life flight children? Do we have to transport them by ambulance? Can we tell the parents they can take them in a car quickly to have an echo done? Again, I was left with having to tell them that it was something that on a individual basis, they had to determine their own protocols. So by October, we'd gotten the feedback on the protocols, and we sent out our second e-blast to all these individuals who are listed here. And we included what the protocols were, what the finalized protocols were, an update letter from us, a link to our website. We developed a frequently asked questions sheet that sort of took them through a number of the different questions that we were getting hit with. We also told them that they would be required to submit to us on a monthly basis. So this was the part where we started addressing the data. We have an integrated data system where we are linking to birth certificates, newborn screening results, hearing screening results, and our latest application, which we refer to as INSTEP, and that's for the Indiana Newborn Screening Tracking and Education Program. It's really our third generation application. And the way we constructed it is it's basically modularized. So it didn't take our programmers a whole lot of time to develop a new module for congenital heart defects. The key issue was, what specifically are we going to be asking the hospitals to report to us? Based on our conversations with the birthing facilities, we decided to go very similar to what we were doing with other monthly summary reports for newborn screening and for hearing screening. And that was, we would like to know those children who did not pass. And if they did not pass, we would like to know where they were referred to. We would like to know those children who were transferred to another facility before they received the pulse oximetry screen. And we would like to know those children who did not receive a pulse oximetry screen and why they did not receive it. Because one of the things that we recognized is it would be legally possible for a parent to refuse pulse oximetry screening based on religious reasons, which also meant we had to change the religious waiver. So we developed the second survey at that time, and we asked very quick questions. We really wanted to ascertain at this point whether everybody had been alerted to the fact that pulse oximetry screening, CCHD screening, would go statewide January 1st, and to make sure that they had some sort of protocols in place as to where that they were going to refer these children to. So that's what this survey really was trying to determine. What facility do you come from, and where are you going to be referring these children to? And we heard back from initially 94 birthing facilities. That was as of 1227. I think we got up to 97, but then we found out that there were a few birthing facilities that had closed, a few we were still working on, contacts who had left, things like that. So, but for the most part, we heard back from all of the different birthing facilities. And what we saw was a slight change in some of the numbers. We saw that 46.8, so almost 47% of the echoes would actually be performed in the same facility, slightly lower what we had heard before. But we did get that information, and we were able to confirm that the different facilities were aware of it, and they did have protocols in place to move forward. So based on the feedback we got, as I mentioned before, we had updated the religious waiver form. We updated the professionals' website, gave them a little bit more information, and we created a parent education sheet. So here is here's just part of our web page. It seems to go on longer and longer every day now. And this is actually the education sheet. And this was something that we reviewed internally. We had physicians look at. And we'd also sent it to the mother of an Indiana child whose daughter had one of the heart defects. And she reviewed it, and she gave us her input on it as well. And we were able to make some adjustments to it as well. The monthly summary report, I think I've already talked about this. Like I said, our programmers were able to move fairly quickly on this. We had this up and tested in about 6 weeks. So where we are right now with this is every birthing facility has an individual who can log into our web-based application and enter information for heel stick screening and for hearing screening. This is another module like that. We have a problem, though, and that is that some of the birthing centers have designated another individual to enter the information. So we also had to develop a web or a paper form and distribute that to the birthing centers so that they could enter the same information on paper, fax it to us, and we would have to have staff enter the information into our own system until we can get all the facilities trained. Right now, it's about 50-50. In terms of long-term, where do we want to go with this? Well, we've discussed this is good and this is the way newborn screening had worked in the past, but our ultimate goal is to have all the screening information for each one of these children because we want to make it readily available to pediatricians when the child is in their office. And we've had discussions about if we don't have any information, can we say that means that child passed? And none of us feel comfortable with that. We feel we need the information. So how do we get that information? There are two ways that we've looked at it. Currently, with what we're doing with hearing screening, we're getting that information on the blood spot card. We've talked about what that would mean if we added congenital heart disease to the blood spot card as well, and we're looking at about an 8 by 11 card at this point. It's still being considered. The other thing that we have discussed is contracting with an outside vendor and getting the results directly from the screening equipment. And that is something that it seems very feasible, and we are actually in the process of contract negotiations with that right now. We're hoping that this is the way we can go, but it's still up in the air at this point. So a little bit more about the monthly summary report. I think I've already gone through this. What the did not pass or they did not receive a valid screen, that was another exception code that the birthing centers would be entering into it. The long-term follow-up or the long-term information. As I'd mentioned, the way pulse oximetry screening or CCHD screening had gotten added to the newborn screening law, there was no diagnosis, no follow-up part attached to it. So this was completely separate. This put us in a little bit of a dilemma, and the pediatricians and the neonatologists and the pediatric cardiologists agreed that that was not sufficient. We needed to know outcomes for these different newborns as to what happened. So how were we going to do that? There was talk about linking it to the Birth Defects and Problems Registry, as these conditions are on the Birth Defects and Problems Registry, but it means drastic revisions to the Birth Defects and Problems Registry. As I'd mentioned previously, our in-step application is our third generation. Our Birth Defects and Problems Registry was our very first web-based application. Our Birth Defects and Problems Registry functions by getting billing codes from hospitals on children up to the age of 3. We have a hybrid system where we have chart auditors who will go to the individual hospitals, and I will remind you there are 100 birthing centers throughout the state of Indiana, and look at these children's medical records. They are reportable to the children are reportable to the Birth Defects and Problems Registry up to the age of 3. And it is about 3 years later that we are doing audits on these children. That is insufficient for CCHD. So that means there needs to be some major changes made to the Birth Defects and Problems Registry so that we can act a little quicker on that. And that's some of the things that we're considering right now. We also had to have some discussions with our legal staff about if we have a child who did not pass their pulse oximetry screening and we knew where they were referred, could we turn that child over to the Birth Defects and Problems Registry and go audit their chart? I was a little concerned about what they would say, but they said that yes, that is something that we could do to confirm that the child actually did not have a birth defects or did not have heart disease. And so this is how we plan on utilizing the information in the Birth Defects and Problems Registry to ensure that those children who did not pass their screening receive the follow-up care, evaluate the health-related outcomes for those children, and evaluate and potentially modify the current standards of care for Indiana children with CCHDs. So where do we stand right now in Indiana? What's still hanging out there? Well, I've already mentioned it. Probably the number one thing is the lack of protocols for premature NICU or unhealthy newborns. The second thing is the lack of recommendations for newborns discharged prior to 24 hours. When I was first asked about that, I thought, well, we could do the same thing that we do with the hearing screening or the blood spot screening. It became obvious to me after some discussions with some of the nurses that that was not the case. This is different. It is slightly, it just won't fit to have the exact same protocols. So in terms of recommendations for having those children come back or go to a facility, and if it's the case of a home birth, you know, in what time frame does that need to occur? Something that needs to be addressed. Lack of recommendations for asymptomatic newborns who need to be transported for an echo is another thing that needs to be addressed. And finally, I'm trying to think of just how many of the birthing centers asked me about which pulse oximeters, which probes were acceptable, because they wanted an actual list, and I was unable to provide them with that, and I haven't been able to find one. So if there's anybody in the room right now who happens to know of such a list, please tell me, because I would I'd really appreciate finding out about that. Some other questions. Will there be any accreditation for referral sites? We were talking about this in respect to what we do with cystic fibrosis. There are different centers that are CF accredited, and we can say with confidence these are the facilities that they should go to. But right now the recommendation is the children should have a pediatric echo that is reviewed by a pediatric cardiologist. Are all of those the same? You know, what I was hearing is there is some difference. So it's just something that has been asked. How will the program be evaluated? What data should be collected, specifically on cost analysis, and how should that be collected? Because that's proving a little difficult too. Fortunately, I feel like we do have a pretty good relationship with some of the hospitals, and they've offered to provide us with some of this information, but they would just like to know what we are going to be asking for. Once the FDA makes its recommendations for pulse oximeters, will funding be made available to birthing centers to meet these recommendations? because again, we have some smaller birthing centers in the state of Indiana who this is a concern, how they will cover the cost of buying these. And finally, what CPT codes will be developed for this? We've heard the same thing, where there is problems with billing for screening. Some have been able to roll it into the overall newborn screening cost, but there have been problems with that as well. Future activities, this is something that we've said pretty much from the start. Pulse oximetry screening in Indiana will be a work in progress, and it'll be a work in progress for a while. We plan on implementing more data collection as we move forward. Hopefully, we will go down the path of the electronic transmission of that data from the oximeters. We will make sure that we train the individuals who will be entering the information on the monthly summary reports to us, so that hopefully by June, July of 2012, all of the facilities will be reporting to us electronically instead of by paper, or instead of half of them by paper. And we hope to develop additional parent education material as we move forward. So, any question? I feel like I've gotten these looks quite a bit over the past few months. So.
Well, again, Bob, thank you for a nice presentation and another good example of a real serious effort and some of the barriers and the hurdles you need to go through to implement this. So I think this is very telling to the committee and very important for us as we understand the implications of what we do and what recommendations are made. So thank you. Comments? Questions? Was there any interaction between you and other states that are doing this so you could sort of talk to them about some of the same pains they were going through? Or?
I actually regret I did not get in touch with New Jersey. I did hear from a number of states who were calling me, asking me what we were doing.
Mm-hmm.
So, but that was the level of it. And
okay.
It, with the way it was added to our law, I think it was a little different, too. I think that made it a little unique.
Unique. Okay. Thank you. Other questions or comments? If not, thank you again for the presentation. I think are there any other issues for the committee? I think the only thing that I want to mention is that the Wisconsin group has indicated that they would, brought the nomination for the 22Q11 deletion syndrome. Will provide us additional data on distribution severe immune deficiency and critical congenital heart lesions in the wider spectrum of patients with the disorder. I have not received that yet, but when we do, we'll go ahead and post that along with the other information concerning the meeting. Any other issues that need to come forward? Sarah?
Nope. See you in May.
Okay. If not, thank you very much. Thank you. And for all your contributions to the meeting. Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay. So we were going to meet real fast.
Yeah. Okay.
Real fast.